Hello and welcome to the special edition of the Saxo Market Call. It is Thursday, 21st of October, 2021. With the Saxo Strategy Team tooth on the ground to bring our normal daily podcast, we decided we would bring you a great interview we had, a great opportunity we had as well, to interview Kathy Wood of the famous ARK Innovation Fund. And we recorded this back last week, October 12th. Head of Equity Strategy, Peter Garnery, and our Chief Investment Officer, Stein Jakobsen, interviewing Kathy Wood on all the areas that the ARK Innovation Fund invests in and her vision for the future in a number of ways. It's a great interview. There is a brief 2 minutes at the start where they are waiting for Kathy Wood to come online, but I left it in there because I think it's great to hear what they're anticipating and looking forward to asking Kathy in their interview. So without further ado, please enjoy the interview. We'll bring the second half of it tomorrow. If you want to see the original video, I provide a link in the podcast description. There are no visuals or anything. It is just a straightforward interview with talking heads. But if you'd like to see that video, you can follow that link there. So enjoy.
So while we wait, maybe Peter, we can talk a little bit about how you expect to have the chat with Kathy. I know you have a number of questions for Kathy, but what are you most excited about this this chat this afternoon?
Well, I'm excited because thematic investing and being looking fine to the future actually happened in the investment community back in the late 1990s, but it disappeared after the dot-com burst, and we got to talk much more in equities about, you know, value factors and momentum factors and the emerging markets as a new phenomenon. And then I would say ARK Invest and Kathy have really put back thematic investing and looking fine to the future back into the investment community. And I think it's actually shaping a lot of ideas and ways of looking at equities. You and I often also talk about, I mean, valuation on equities. And it seems like there have been a paramount shift in the way equity investors look at some companies. They discount with a higher conviction than ever, you know, a positive future. And definitely some of the technology vectors that Kathy is sort of representing here, I find very interesting. And you also know, Stein, because you basically told us to go in that direction. We have to talk about the big, broad mega trends and themes that shape the world. So we're doing some of the same things as Kathy, but we're doing it on an inspirational level, where she's really putting money on the table, so to speak. And I think it's a very inspiring story. Also because I think ultimately investors, we talked about it over lunch, right? And people want to hear a positive message, basically.
Yeah, no, very much. And I think that is really one of the one of the jobs that Kathy and the team has done best, is to, one, define there is a future and a sort of a travel away from this giving up on the future. And secondly, that, you know, using the network effect as the price mechanism to some extent, at least that's how I see it from my chair being a trader and a portfolio manager, that you know, it seems like this concept of the future value of a company is the amount of the square root on the amount of users. Of course, being an old geezer who comes from a bottom-up macro perspective, I would also like to make a little bit of money in terms of reoccurring revenue stream. But how do you see that fight between the square root of users relatively to the fundamental lesson that you were taught in business school?
Oh,
I think we've been joined by Kathy. Can you hear us, Kathy?
Hallelujah.
You have nothing to apologize for. I mean, getting up at 7 o'clock standing by is amazing, Kathy. So no apologies needed. We have just been buying a little bit of time. And if you didn't listen in, we have been praising you, among other things, for being a trailblazer in terms of performance. But for an old geezer like me, at least with over 30 years experience similar to you, I think what you really do is that you put a positive spin to a world which is increasingly meeting a lot of obstacles and limitations in terms of how we think about the world. And I'm not even talking about politics here, Kathy. I'm just talking about the fact that the world. So maybe if you wouldn't mind, just go into it. I gave an introduction. I talked about your trailblazing performance. You've been giving a lot of credit up front. Don't worry, you get more during the interview. But to setting the scene, and I think it's pretty fair to the viewers and listeners right now, to make them aware that your fund is not as a concept built to be the same as the capital weighted index. I know you talk about that extensively every time you go on TV, because I think it is important. I mean, me as a portfolio manager, not that that matters, but I see your fund as something I have for 5 to 10% for the alpha, for the potential to be the upside scale, the exponential value of something. Maybe you want to address that upfront, because I think that sets the scene really well for what we're going to delve into afterwards.
Okay, yes. The way in the early days, in order to help people understand what we were doing, we used to say, look, you may not believe in our forecast, our exponential growth trajectories, all of which are a function of extensive modeling. But if we're right, your benchmark sensitive portfolio or benchmark aware portfolio is going to be populated increasingly by value traps, stocks that are cheap for a reason. But if we're right, many are going to be disrupted or disintermediated by the most profound changes that have been technologically enabled in the history of the world. And many people will say, okay, that sounds like hyperbole. It is not hyperbole. I founded ARK in 2014 because I saw a dearth of research and investing in innovation in the public equity markets. And I saw that the tech and telecom bust and the 08-09 meltdown had put extreme fear into our business. And so hugging benchmarks became the safe way to go. We think that that will not be the safe way to go during the next 5 to 10 years. And just to give you, to frame this up for you, in 2019, truly transformative innovation was the market cap of truly transformative innovation was roughly $9 trillion globally. I mean, 7 trillion. So it was less than 10% of the total public equity market cap. If we are correct, that number during the next 10 years, and this is a revision, it will go to $220 trillion. And in the process of all of this disruptive innovation will be creative destruction. That is the other side of disruptive innovation, the disintermediation, the disruption of the traditional world order. We've never had five innovation platforms evolving at the same time. The closest we can come to this in history has been in the early 1900s, telephone, electricity, and automobile. And those did transform the world. They cut across economic sectors, and they were launching pads for more innovation. The same thing is true of DNA sequencing, robotics, including adaptive and collaborative robotics, energy storage, artificial intelligence, and blockchain technology. And not only is each of these five platforms scaling exponentially now, the time is now, but they are converging. And the kinds of explosive growth that we believe are going to come out of this convergence can be characterized by autonomous taxi networks. Autonomous taxi networks will be the convergence of three of these major innovation platforms: robotics, autonomous vehicles are robots, energy storage, they will be electric, and artificial intelligence, they will be powered by artificial intelligence. This opportunity alone, we believe, will deliver revenues in 10 years of roughly $10 trillion globally. Now, the numbers I gave you before were market caps. This is actual revenues, 10 trillion, according to our estimates, versus zero now. And that's the next 10 years. So our lives are going to transform in a way that we can't even comprehend now. But what ARK is trying to do is educate not only investors, but parents and grandparents to steer their children and grandchildren to the right side of change, stay away from the creative destruction, and move into disruptive innovation. So I hope that's a good setup
It was very eloquent. I can tell you've done it a few times before, Kathy, in terms of explaining the strategy. And it's, as a trader, I mean, really what you're saying is that you buy optionality tickets, you buy small deltas of a lot of things, not trying to predict which one will work, but it sits inside these mega trends. And I think that is important for the clients. I know you've often been quoted by saying that people more when you're interviewed want to talk about the risk than the upside. But I have to start at this. I mean, you will forgive me for wanting to start on this energy crisis that seems to be emerging.
Oh,
And just, I understand fully that you will, of course, argue in a minute that the compounding effect of all you just said will outpace the short-term effect on the energy crisis. But how do you see your model? How do you see the stocks over the next 0 to 24 months in what we have deemed to be the paradigm we think we are in is that the physical world has simply reached its limit due to underinvestment, but also due to the fact that technology and otherwise, we are not capable of extending this elasticity. You and I grew up with when we switched on a light, the light, there was electricity. That is, right now around the world, not the fact. That's talk in the UK having a 3-day work week. Clearly, this, at a bare minimum, slows down some of the process you talk about, or does it?
It actually accelerates it because innovation solves problems. And we had a very good example of that in the COVID crisis. I remember I did a YouTube video weekly because we had a point of view. And my background is economics as well as finance. And our point of view at the time was, look, the world is going through a shock. It's a shock to our system. And the COVID crisis has created a lot of problems. Innovation solves problems. Technologically enabled innovation, better, cheaper, faster, more productive, more creative, especially solves problems. And so, if anything, the energy crisis is going to accelerate the shift towards electric vehicles. That is already happening. Just today, we got numbers from China and the new energy vehicle segment, this is a September number for China, was up 202%, whereas total sales were down 13% on a year-over-year basis, total auto sales. And oh, by the way, Tesla sales in China were up 51%. So there is an accelerated shift towards electric vehicles. Now, to address your supply concerns, I agree with you completely. What we're seeing now is severe underinvestment in many industries. Energy, probably the most important. And one of the reasons is because of the ESG mandates of pension funds and foundations. They have been influencing large energy-related companies to shift their investment away from traditional fossil fuels toward the new energy, the renewables in particular. And so we're seeing a dearth of capital spending in the oil industry now, much like, and now I've been made fun of for saying this, but you have to go back to the whale oil crisis to see a similar phenomenon. At one point, whale oil was the source of our energy, used to light up our homes. But as we were discovering fossil fuels, the investment in whale oil collapsed. So what happened to whale oil prices? During that collapse, they were very volatile, both on the upside and the downside, as the shift towards fossil fuels began to take hold. But the resolution of that volatility was to the downside. And so we're seeing energy prices, oil prices in particular, that are much higher than we thought they were going to go. Not because of the demand side, it is because of the supply side. In fact, we do believe that the demand for oil, and this still holds true, peaked into 2019. I believe it was, I won't get these numbers exactly right, but something like 104 million barrels per day. And I think we're back up to, we got to roughly 90 during the crisis. And then this year, we're up to roughly 97. Now, forecasts are that we will go out to a new high in 2022. But if we're right, we're maybe we'll skirt with a new high. I doubt it, because what we're beginning to see is the impact of some of these demand, these price increases on demand. Consumers are pulling back, and they can pull back. Unlike in the 70s, when we went through the quadrupling of oil prices because of the OPEC cartel, we had no choice. We had to drive to work. And I remember I had just gotten my driver's license in California. I was, you know, four cars deep around a block to wait for gasoline. Today we can stay home. And we've gotten a lot of practice during the last 18 months. And so I think we're going to see a reaction, a demand reaction to these price increases. The other thing that we're going on since we're speaking of, that we believe is going on since we're speaking about risks is many, many people, I think, look at auto dealer lots. Here in the United States, there's very little inventory in, on the lots, just 17 days of inventory. Normal is around 60 days. And many are saying to me, you're completely wrong about what's going to happen to the auto sector here. Because what we believe is during the COVID crisis, in order to avoid mass transit, a lot of people bought new and used cars. We had a 60% increase in used car prices. Where are those cars now? They're not on dealer lots. They're in our garages or our driveways, our parking lots, and they represent excess inventory. We probably wouldn't have bought that extra car, certainly not here in the United States, if it weren't for the coronavirus. And this is true of a lot of goods. We spent a disproportionate amount on goods because we could order them online, not on services. In the United States, goods account for only a third of consumption, but they went well north of 40% last year. What does that tell us? Well, we have a lot of excess inventory stored in our homes, whether it's toilet tissue or Clorox, and we're seeing the fallout from that now. Many of these companies are reporting decline in sales. So I think there's a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos. But we do believe that the impact of price increases will not be to feed through and cause a wage price spiral. We think instead technologically enabled innovation is going to accelerate, productivity is going to accelerate, and to the extent wages are going up because of labor shortages, many people don't want to go back to work because they're fearful. Then productivity gains will do a lot to offset those wage gains.
All right. Now that we have talked a little bit about the risks, Kathy, we also want to talk about the future, your bold vision for the future. And can you take us through what the world will look like in 30 years from now through your lens with the different technology vectors that you have invested in? I mean, what would the world be like in 30 years? Is it 100% renewable energy, autonomous vehicles? We have individual medicine. I mean, take us through what the world will look like in 30 years.
Sure. And I'll start out by saying the seeds for what is happening now were planted during the 20 years that ended in the tech and telecom bubble. Back then, too much capital chased too few ideas too soon. What do I mean by that? Too soon meant the technologies were not ready and the costs were not low enough. And just to illustrate one idea there or example, DNA sequencing, which is going to transform healthcare completely. DNA sequencing, the first whole human genome sequenced was in 2003. It took $2.7 billion and 13 years of computing power to sequence the first whole human genome. Even if costs had collapsed 75% the next year, we were not ready for prime time. Today, we're down to $500 her whole human genome in a few hours of computing power. So we are at the threshold of each of us getting our own geneticist or having our doctors consult with geneticists. And for the first time in history, we can identify mutations in our genomes. So there are 6 billion bits of code in our genomes, 3 billion base pairs of DNA. So six, and this is the double helix. So 6 billion bits of code. Until now, it was either too expensive or not possible to identify one mutation, which is a programming error in those 6 billion bits of code. Now we can isolate a mutation. Why is that important? Mutations are the earliest manifestation of disease. And all they are programming errors. Now, on top of being able to identify them, there are therapies already in place that will help address some of them, not all of them, in fact, not many of them. We're learning so much that the therapies will follow. But one of the most important therapies is CRISPR gene editing and other gene therapies. With gene editing and base editing and prime editing, we believe that we will be able not only to reprogram our genome and to correct the programming error, but we will also be able, thanks to the convergence of DNA sequencing, artificial intelligence, and CRISPR gene editing, we will be able to discover when our bodies are setting up to move into a disease state, when they're setting up to move into stage one cancer. We'll be able to catch cancer before stage one. And we believe we will, with time, and this is going to take a lot of time, be able to reprogram our genomes and cure the disease. So that probably will, to get to that state of perfection, will take 10 to 20 to 30 years. But we do believe that the next 10 years are going to bring such hope. Already we've seen with immunotherapies, training our own bodies to fight cancer, to identify cancer and then fight it. That's causing miracles, miracle cures in cancer. We're going to see a lot more miracle cures because of this convergence of DNA sequencing, artificial intelligence, and gene therapies. So healthcare as we know it is going to transform completely. Now, the pushback we will get on that is, oh my goodness, here in the United States, we spend nearly 20% of our GDP on healthcare, double the rest of the world. And so the question we'll get is, this is going to be a real problem for us in terms of the cost continuing to explode. That is not true. What is going to happen in healthcare is this, and I'm not making light of this, is the same thing that happened to advertising. Before Google and Facebook and Twitter and other social media, advertisers used to say, I know that half of my advertising works. I just don't know which half. That's even more true in healthcare. The guesswork that has taken place in healthcare over the last, and this was doctors and scientists doing the best they could with the knowledge they had. But the guesswork, we believe, certainly here in the United States, given how litigious our society is, has caused more surgeries than necessary, and probably, in the case of thyroid cancer, for example, probably twice the number, more than twice the number of cancer, of thyroid cancer surgeries than were necessary. Same with chemotherapy. I remember in the early days of Genomic Health, a company that helped doctors discover which of their patients with breast cancer would benefit from chemotherapy. And roughly half did not benefit from chemotherapy. All it did was hurt them. All it did was harm them. It took a long time for doctors to believe that this test was true and that they wouldn't be sued for a false negative. And so, it's taken time for these new tools and new therapies to move into the system. But now there's a belief that, hey, this is going to change healthcare. This is going to cause cures. And this could cut costs as we eliminate unnecessary expenses. Our biggest medical, our biggest liability as a country here in the United States is the medical retirement liability. We believe that liability, as we're actually curing disease and identifying disease and targeting our therapies more appropriately and more specifically, more precisely, our medical retirement liabilities are actually going to go down. And I feature Kathy, healthcare first. Yes.
If I didn't know better. No, it's fine. If I don't know any better, I would say you're on a crusade here. And it seems like this, I can see the light in your eyes. And this is something that really talks to you. And I think you did really well in explaining why you're doing what you do and what you're trying to achieve. So I think we're absolutely with you on that. But we want to explore a few other things with you as well, Kathy. And one is, of course...
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.